The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right. Does that work?
Yeah.
Everyone can hear me? All right. So the reason that we're doing this talk, like Dave said, is that the right wing is under the impression that it is rallying for free speech, and that is what its legacy is. In a very big way, this started in Berkeley. The Berkeley College Republicans tried to bring several right-wing provocateurs this year. The university and protesters at various times attempted or successfully stopped them. They announced that the free speech movement is dead and that they are the new fighters for free speech on campus. And the reason that they get away with this, I mean, it's total nonsense, but the reason they get away with this is that no one actually knows the history and legacy of the free speech movement. It's been repeatedly disfigured in people's recollections and the university's recollections, and so it's worth actually looking at the history to see if that's true. So the reason that the FSM matters and the reason that we have a lot to learn from it, there's three reasons that I'll give. The first is that it was the first major sustained campus revolt of the 1960s, since the 1930s, and it re-injected politics, left politics, onto campuses, Berkeley first, but then later others after McCarthyism, and it kind of got campuses out of that era. The second reason is that it involved and adopted the politics of civil rights and made space for the later politics of the anti-war movement, and these were part of and not separate from the fight for free speech. The third reason, and this is particularly relevant for all of us on campus, is that it developed an analysis of the campus power structure. So a lot of the things that were written about the administration of the 1960s on Berkeley and elsewhere are definitely still relevant today. So there are some incorrect interpretations that I want to set forward now, and then I think the history will kind of speak for itself about why these interpretations are incorrect. So the first one, of course, is what the right says, which is that either they don't explain the history of the free speech movement, they just kind of say, you know, this is Berkeley, free speech is important, our free speech is being lost, so therefore the free speech movement is dead. Or they say, you know, the liberals used to care about civil liberties, the left used to care about civil liberties, but now you have this regressive left that is betraying the free speech movement. The second interpretation was given in January of 2017 by a group of free speech movement veterans and historians. In advance of a planned talk by Milo Yiannopoulos at Berkeley, they wrote an article in the student newspaper, The Daily Californian, where they slammed Milo as a bigot accurately, and they correctly said that because of the legacy of FSM, the university should not ban Milo from campus. However, they also said that students should not protest Milo, they should not attempt to disrupt him or shut him down, and that the best thing to do in response, given the legacy of the FSM, they say, is to go in and ask him tough questions. The third interpretation is what I would call an ultra-left interpretation, and it was given in May of this year in an article in Truthout titled "The Home of Free Speech, A Critical Perspective on UC Berkeley's Coalition with the Far Right." They write that the free speech movement represented a shift in left politics in Berkeley from civil rights to a, quote, politically tepid free speech fight on campus. They write that the FSM was, quote, politically incoherent because it included conservatives in its coalition, and it was a largely, quote, white male middle class movement. So let's get into the actual history, and I think it'll prove a lot of this wrong. There's a lot of archive material of the FSM, so I think to make it more interesting for y'all, I'll do some quotes and I'll include some of this awesome music and audio that you're hearing, make the morning a little more interesting. So let's start with an overview of that campus power structure. One of the biggest figures, one of the biggest antagonists of the free speech movement was the president of the UC system, University of California at the time, President Clark Kerr. So this is the guy that's in charge of all of the campuses, and then on individual campuses like Berkeley, you also have chancellors. A lot of this analysis is pulled from The Mind of Clark Kerr, a pamphlet written by Hal Draper, and it was published by the International Socialists right after the FSM began. It regards a book that Clark Kerr wrote in 1963 called The Uses of the University. So in this book, he basically writes that in the U.S. there's been a shift from the importance of industries like railroads to automobiles, and now you have the knowledge industry. So he writes, quote, "Today the campus is being drawn to the city hall and the state capitol as never before. The politicians need new ideas to meet the new problems," and he says the professors can supply that. And his role as an administrator is now not to educate students, but to play the role of a mediator, to balance interests between off-campus people who are trying to use campus resources to help themselves, including City Hall, the interests of students, and the interests of professors. He says that the mediator, quote, has to find satisfaction in being equally distasteful to each of his constituency. So in describing this kind of new society that's arising, he basically says that we have a new form of society that is based around bureaucracy rather than around economy or anything else, or conflict. So he says, quote, class warfare will be forgotten, and in its place will be the bureaucratic contest. Memos will flow instead of blood. So you might think, you know, there might be some people who disagree with this. There might be people who want a different kind of society. And so he has a discussion of the quote-unquote nonconformists. So in a later recollection, this is how he applies that framework to the FSM. He describes the FSM as, quote, a coming together of many individuals in a rather unruly mass, reacting ad hoc to actions by the campus administration, no overall plan. Just spur-of-the-moment reactions, but also a general inclination to cause trouble and to enjoy and even glory in it. At the time, he also wrote that a few of the nonconformists seek to turn the university on the Latin American model into a fortress from which they can sally forth with impunity to make their attacks on society. So there's kind of a, and by the way, when he's talking about these Latin American universities, he's talking about the growing radical student unions at these universities, which were fighting against repression and dictatorships that the U.S. supported. So that's what he finds. He calls it a perversion of academic life. So there's a contradiction that you might be seeing in what he's saying, that on the one hand, he thinks it's important for the campus, the professors, to go and help politicians, to help City Hall, but on the other hand, he doesn't want students and people carrying out attacks on the Latin American model on society. And so that contradiction, that it's okay to support power structures in the outside society, but it's not okay to support the oppressed, that will be at the heart of the FSM conflicts. Now, this whole vision of the university as a bureaucracy, as being research-based, that has a real effect on undergraduate life. So it's a shift away from the kind of traditional liberal arts education, and it's a shift away from university administrators maybe as playing a role in student education and more as managers. One result of this is that in 1964, when the FSM took place, a full third of the student body at Berkeley were grad students. And so these grad students worked on the campus as teaching assistants and research assistants, and that will play a very important role in the FSM as well. The other important kind of part of the university power structure is the regents. And in 1965, Marvin Garson, who was a member of the FSM, wrote a pamphlet on this where he basically laid out how the regents were an assortment of business leaders. So you had the chairman of the largest department store in the West, the director of the Northrop Corporation, which supplies military aircrafts, the chairman of the Bank of America, the director of the company that publishes the LA Times, the vice president of Lockheed Aircraft, and I can basically go down the line. So basically all of the California ruling class is basically on the board of regents. The last thing that I'll say is the faculty of UC Berkeley, in a very real way, were part of this power structure, or at least supported it during the conflict. In 1966, this is how Joel Geyer described the relationship between faculty and students. Quote, this animal is wicked. It defends itself when attacked. That's what the reasonable, sweet faculty have against us, that when we are attacked, we will fight back, that we are not going to be the patsies that many of them have become, that we are not going to become intellectual flunkies for the university administration. Hal Draper, who participated... Hal Draper, who was a major intellectual and activist in the free speech movement, wrote that the most virulent enemies of the free speech movement among the faculty were a hardcore group of ex-radicals who had made their own peace with the system. So in many ways, these people were radicals in the 30s. They kind of gave that up, joined the power structure, and would go on to be many of the what we now think of as neoconservatives. Okay, so that's the power structure. So now I want to give you a little bit of an overview of the fight back that was happening at the time. One major protest that happened early on in 1960 was a protest against HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was doing investigations of communists and alleged communists and basically anyone who spoke up for their rights or for the left. In 1960, HUAC subpoenaed a Berkeley student, and in response, hundreds of Berkeley students went to San Francisco City Hall to protest them at a hearing. They were shut out of the hearing. Hundreds of them sat in, and the police used fire hoses to wash them down the stairs of the city hall. So this event would play a very big role in galvanizing and upsetting students, and in many ways was the beginning of the student movement. So one of the most important things to understand about Berkeley student life, and in many ways this is still true today, is that while this was the beginning of the birth of the new left, so many people were not in organizations, many people did not have established like socialist consciousness, there were established left groups on campus with an active membership of about 200 to 300. And they played a very big role, including the International Socialists, the precursor to the ISO. They played a very big role in setting forward a political perspective for the movement. So the way Hal Draper describes it is that these radical groups formed the skeleton about which the FSM fleshed itself. And then when the movement got tough, it would always be those radical groups that stuck around and held the reins and pushed the movement forward, while the Social Democrats, the Democrats, and the Republicans would drop out. So just as an example, the very first public meeting of the International Socialists was held a couple days before the FSM began. It was on what would become this Mind of Clark Kerr pamphlet that Hal Draper wrote. So he gave a talk on Clark Kerr's vision of the university. And Mario Savio and Jack Weinberg, who would go on to become leaders of the free speech movement, were at that meeting. And Mario writes that the pamphlet contributed mightily to the movement's understanding of the extent and depth of the injustice by which the multiversity runs. And a historian would later write that people like Mario, Jack, and other leaders of the free speech movement used, quote, Draperian rhetoric when they were describing the university. So I think we should all use Draperian rhetoric. That sounds great. So, like I said at the beginning, the fight for free speech and the free speech movement at Berkeley is inseparable from the civil rights fight that was happening at the time. Just a quick overview of the racist conditions in the Bay Area and in Berkeley specifically. During World War II, there was a massive black migration to the Bay Area to participate in, basically the federal government, creates these giant war industries and they recruit many black workers from the South to come work in the Bay. So in 1940, the Berkeley black population was 4% of the population, and in 1960, it's 20%. So there's a massive migration. And they lived in a segregated area of Berkeley, largely Southwest Berkeley, which, to be honest, is very much still the case today. But after after the war was over, they were basically kicked out of the war industries and then segregated and left unemployed. So the unemployment at the time was 4% overall, but 11% for black people. 1.5% of workers in grocery stores in the city were black, and a survey of 20 banks found that there was only one black worker, and he was the maintenance guy. In 1965, there was apparently only one black waitress in the entire city. As one employer explains, quote, I'm not prejudiced, I just prefer to have an all-white staff. As another explains, quote, they wouldn't fit in, and besides, we don't have adequate washroom facilities. So this wasn't just the city. The same conditions were absolutely true at the university. In 1967, the student population was about like 26, 27,000. There were, in that population, there were only 236 black students, 68 Chicano students, and 36 Native American students. In 1964, there was an incident when a university cop asked a black student for his registration card, basically his ID card in the student union. He refused to show it because the cop was only asking him and not any of the other white students there, and he was jailed. So anyway, all of that is happening, but there is also a very big fight back that takes place in the fall of 1963 and the spring of 1964. There's mass picketing of multiple restaurants. One restaurant, Mel's Drive-In, its owner was the Republican candidate for San Francisco mayor. Hundreds of students occupied seats and didn't order, so it was a sit-in. 100 of them were arrested and they won an employment agreement. Later in the spring, there were shop-ins at the Lucky Supermarket, which had the smallest percentage of black workers of any Bay Area grocery chain. And basically what they did is they would go in, take goods off the shelves, go to the cash register, and then say, oh wait, I forgot my wallet, sorry. And so they did this until the store was forced to agree to hire more black workers. One of the biggest events were pickets and sit-ins at the San Francisco Sheraton Palace, which is a major hotel. They, out of their 550 workers, they only hired 20 black workers, and they were all in menial positions. Thousands of students participated over the course of many weeks protesting this. There were pickets, major sit-ins, and hundreds of arrests. Actually, basically, it got up to about 1,000 arrests. They were condemned by the liberal Governor Brown, by newspapers like the San Francisco Chronicle and the student newspaper The Daily Cal, but they did win an employment agreement. And then on campus, they brought the director of CORE, James Farmer, to speak to 1,000 students. James Baldwin spoke to 9,000 students. So there was an active civil rights movement, and this galvanized students. Mario Savio recalls that 10% of the students in Berkeley campus, meaning about 3,000, did civil rights work at some point. And even among those that didn't, there was widespread interest in what was happening. So students went to Mississippi, and race and civil rights issues were constantly on the front page of the newspaper. This also meant that the cadre of the FSM were very prepared for a fight. Clark Kerr himself recalls that he misjudged the FSM's willingness to use civil disobedience that was developed in Alabama and Mississippi. They, quote, took us completely by surprise. As one student recalls, quote, a student who has been chased by the KKK in Mississippi is not easily scared by academic bureaucrats. So going into the fall of 1964, when the FSM begins, Mario Savio is the president of the university chapter of SNCC. And that's a really important fact to understand the mindset that him and other activists are in, and the training and the politics that they bring to the fight. So on September 2nd, the civil rights organizations announced a picketing of the Oakland Tribune, which is a pro-Barry Goldwater, who is the Republican segregationist candidate. It's owned by a former Republican Senator William Noland. So on September 2, they make an announcement. September 3rd, this is of 1964, the Tribune prints a front page statement by Noland denouncing this plan to picket. And then September 4th, Berkeley students begin busing down to the Tribune, and the picketing begins. And it's on that same day that the Berkeley administration first begins discussing whether the political restrictions need to be changed. So for decades on Berkeley campus, all political activity had been banned. And when Clark Kerr, in the transition of Clark Kerr becoming president, some of these rules were eased. But he tries to get a reputation for that he doesn't deserve. So while he ended the ban on communist speakers, he now required that a tenured professor would chair any outside speakers, but that basically meant any communist or radical speakers was how it was applied. Political groups were labeled off campus and were forbidden to meet, fundraise, or recruit. And Malcolm X was banned from speaking on campus because he was promoting religion, even though the year before a bishop from San Francisco was allowed to speak. And I mean, despite all of these restrictions still existing, the American Association of University Professors gave Clark Kerr their Academic Freedom Award. So that's kind of the reputation that he has. So for the longest time, the intersection just south of campus at Bancroft and Telegraph had been understood as city property, and so it was exempt from these rules. Hal Draper called this a safety valve for all political activity on campus. So that's where people would table, that's where you pass out leaflets, that's where you'd go to learn about the next civil rights demo. So in the middle of September, the admin announces that it all of a sudden realized that this was actually campus property. So now that's also close to political activity. This, of course, happens just a few days after the Tribune gets picketed and the Tribune starts pressuring the university. In response to this, the quote-unquote off-campus clubs form a united front. And it's a mix of civil rights, socialists, Democrats, and Republican organizations. They begin protesting with picket lines in front of Sproul Hall, the university administration building, with signs that say things like UC manufactures safe mines. And so these protests go on daily. On September 29th, and at the same time, they are setting up tables on Sproul Plaza, which is again that big plaza in front of the administration building. They're setting up tables in violation of the rules. And on September 29th, the university begins checking, begins going up to the tables and seeing who's there and trying to get their names to see why they're tabling, to cite them for violating the rules. So here's how one student recounts that experience. And his name is Brian Turner.
I was the first one, the University of Friends of SNCC table, an organization to which I belonged to for 1 week and one half. I was on this table on Tuesday afternoon, and they came around, and the cop came up to me and said, "You have a permit." I said, "No, you denied me a permit." He said, "Well, I have to ask you to leave." I said, "I can't." He said, "Well, I order you to leave." I said, "I can't." He said, "Well, we'll take away your table." I said, "I can't leave." So he left. Mr. Weaver came by, who was the administrative assistant to Dean Toll, the dean of students. And she said, "Say, babe, you got a permit?" I said, "No, you denied it to me." He said, He said, you know, you're breaking the rule. I said, yeah, it's sort of sad, but this is the interpretation, I gotta break the rule. And she said, well, you know, I have to ask you to leave. I said, well, you know, I can't go. And she said, well, you know, I order you to go. And I said, I can't speak to the organization, it doesn't exist. And she said, well, you know, we're gonna have to take away your papers. I said, well, gee, and she laughed. Early in the morning, you know, Arlene Williams came by, R.D. He said, you know, I don't think you have a permit. I said, you know, you're right, you wouldn't give it to me. He said, you know, you're breaking the law. I said, I know I'm violating your interpretation of this rule, this arbitrary rule. He said, well, you don't have to ask me to leave. And I said, well, you know, I can't. And he said, well, I order you to leave. I said, I really don't have that power. And he said, well, you know, we're going to cut away your table. Will you leave? I said, no, you have to do it. And he left.
So the next day, on September 30th, five students who were cited for violating the rules were summoned to the dean's office. They showed up, but along with them were 500 other people. Three more were cited on the spot, and the 500 people sat in and slept in the dean's office to protest this overnight. So on October 1st, the tabling is still ongoing. Mario Savio is going around informing tablers of the voted on policy to not give their names to the administration when they come by to check. So the United Front had a meeting where they decided this is how we're gonna do it. And so tablers are continuing what they're doing. So, you know, the core table and the SNCC table are asking students for funds to send to Mississippi. They're arguing with students about whether or not this is a legitimate tactic. And it's really interesting, honestly, to listen to this audio, because it all feels exactly the way, you know, my experience of tabling on campuses today. So here's how what Mario says about the policy of not giving names to the deans.
No deans or any other kind of animals or giving of names today. None of that. That's out.
So he calls the deans animals, if you didn't catch that. And here's his call for asking people to give him funds to send to Mississippi.
And your fellow students, contribute to their defense. We're not asking you to be expelled. All we're asking you for is a little money. It's anonymous. It's illegal.
So the deans go to the campus core table and ask Jack Weinberg to move. Here's what they say.
I must inform you, if you are a student, you are violating university regulations, and if you are a non-student, you are violating the trespass law. Will you identify yourself? You leave me no alternative but to ask Lieutenant Chandler to arrest you.
So after he does this, the people around him begin saying, arrest all of us, arrest all of us. And this will continue to be a very important part of the free speech movement, that the power structure, the cops, the administrators will target the leaders, and the rank and file will demand that they be punished as well. So there's a real sense of solidarity. Jack Weinberg is arrested, but unfortunately the cops, what will become an unfortunate mistake on their part, they don't take him away immediately. Instead, they go to get a police car. So Jack is detained, waiting there, and he gives the following speech on Clark Kurt. And you'll notice the Draperian rhetoric here.
I want to tell you about this knowledge factory that we're all sitting here now. It seems that certain of the products are not coming out the standard specifications. Certain of the products are not coming out the standard specifications. And I feel the university is trying to purge these products so they can once again produce for the industry exactly what they specify. If you read Clark Kerr's books, these are his precise words. The Knowledge Factory takes certain assignments, they take orders from industry, they want so many of these, they want so many of these, they want so many of these. The university very, very willingly obliges to this. The university very willingly obliges, and in fact turns out exactly what they are ordered. These are not on-campus groups, by the way, that put these orders in. These are off-campus groups. They put in orders that they want certain kinds of products. This is mass production. No deviations from the norms are tolerated. Occasionally, a few students get together and they decide that they are human beings. Some students get together and they decide that they are not willing to be products, and they protest, and the university, they feel obliged to purge these non-standard products.
So the cops then drive a car onto Sproul Plaza and put Jack Weinberg in. Hundreds of students spontaneously surround the car and refuse to move. That police car would not move for another 32 hours. Very soon after this, Mario Savio mounts the car and lists his demands. Well, the group's demands.
We are asking the following. We will not stop direct action against the administration of this university unless they accede to the following very simple and reasonable demands. Number one, Chancellor Strong, seeing as he's the one who did it, must immediately say that no students have been suspended from the university. Number two, Chancellor Strong must agree to meet with representatives of the off-campus political organizations to discuss with them reasonable regulations governing freedom of speech on this campus, which means no arbitrary restrictions of any kind on freedom of speech on this campus. You must agree to such a meeting. That's demand number two. Demand number three, the final demand is the chancellor must agree that no disciplinary action will be taken against anyone setting up tables or speaking here until, at very, very least, that meeting is held. Please serve me a notice of warning, and I should say threat, to this administration. They will be subject to continuous direct action by us, and it's going to be damn embarrassing for them. We're going to get foreign press, we're going to get domestic press, we're going to get all sorts of organizations against them until they accede to these legitimate demands.
So soon after, Charlie Powell, the president of the student government, gets on the car and says that they should negotiate with the administration. Mario Savio agrees to join him in this, and then he introduces Hal Draper. Hal Draper gets on the car and addresses a contradiction that I brought up earlier. So I'm going to play his speech, but I just want to outline some of the things that he mentioned so it doesn't get confusing. He discusses Professor Edward Teller, who is a major advocate of nuclear energy and basically of the nuclear bomb. He discusses the Giannini Foundation, which is an agricultural think tank on campus that supports growers, the agricultural growers in the Bracero program against the laborers. And then he also discusses the HUAC protest that I mentioned earlier. So here's Hal Draper.
One of the reasons for abolishing the tables, Chancellor Strong told us, was that we could not mount social and political action. The administration could not make that stick for the simple reason that mounting social and political activity on this campus for off-campus purposes goes on this campus every day in the week, except that it's not done by students, it is done by the administration and by faculty. Two examples. One is a professor who is justly famous for his reputation and for his accomplishments, Dr. Edward Teller, a professor with a point of view to which he, like every other faculty member, has a right to, and which he goes about the country expounding. Will anybody tell me that Edward Teller's reputation, his post, his position, his emolument as a prominent member of the University of California faculty is not his base for mounting his political activity in the country? I do not want to limit or restrict his right to do so. The other day, a leading institution of this university came out prominently as sponsoring, intervening in a very important social question off the campus. That was the conflict between the growers of California and farm labor on the Bracero question. Maybe you don't know anything about it, you don't have to. All I want to tell you is this, that just the other day the Giannini Institute came out with an official report at the request of authority in which they unmistakably take the side, well, of whom do you suppose? At any rate, in which they unmistakably take the side of the growers.
They have a right to do that. I am not questioning that. But I am telling you that if the Deering Institute of the University of California can come out and strike a blow off campus, remember, for the growers' side of that dispute, then a few poor students whose name University of California to one tenth of the extent can go likewise and say that they are against discrimination at the Bank of America. In Mr. Kerr's recent book, The Uses of the Interior of the University, one of the things which he stresses, this is in words you understand, is how the days of the cloister and the ivory tower are gone by, society and the university are merging, that more and more of the campus is going to City Hall, and City Hall is coming to the campus. I trust you understand what he's referring to. 4 years ago, the campus, 3 years ago, the campus went to City Hall and got washed down the steps. Mr. Carr is not talking about that kind of merger. He is talking about the fact and encouraging the fact that faculty members, professors, and other people for whom the name of the university.
So anyway, he goes on to basically say that, you know, there's obviously a contradiction between faculty and administrators being allowed to strike these blows and students not being able to, and that it's a political distinction that's being made. So at this point, basically what happens is there's thousands of students surrounding this police car. The police are kind of just standing around really confused about what to do. In the background, the power structure is kind of discussing amongst itself how it should react to this. And speakers, one by one, get on the police car and speak about what they think of the demonstration, what they think of university issues. Some speakers continue to say what Hal is saying, and they give examples of the campus administration taking political stances on issues, on everything from atomic energy to school bonds that are being voted on by the voters. One speaker gets up and reads an open letter by TAs in economics and political science that's for rights to solicit funds and members and is against the discipline being meted out against the 8 suspended students. Brian Turner gets back up and recounts his story about, you know, his interaction with the deans and how he went from being reluctant to give his name to giving his name and becoming one of the 8 suspended students. So here's Brian Turner.
When the cop in the camera stopped it to me when I said I wasn't leaving, he said, do you know what you're letting yourself in for? And I looked at him and I said, you know, I don't know. I'm leaving. But I thought about it that next night, that was Tuesday night. I thought about my responsibility as a student and whether it was worth it to me as one student to give up my privilege of being in this university for a semester or two, so that 27,000 people could have freedom of speech, and it wasn't worth it to me. But it's worth it to us to give up ours for you. How about you stand up for yours?
So there are also many speakers, well, not many, there were some speakers who spoke against. There were hecklers throughout the 2 days that the protesters were there, and there were also a few professors who got up to speak against the demonstration. One, Seymour Lipset, is a major sociology professor. He was appointed by Clark Curry to direct the Institute of International Studies, and he also did research on foreign student movements for the Air Force. He got on the car and said that students were acting like the KKK because Southern segregationists also violate the law because they think they're right. So from 3 to 8 p.m., there's a brief sit-in in Sproul Hall, again, the administration building of about 200 students. They make their way up to the dean's office and demand an appointment to see the dean. I think they want the dean, but back on Sproul Hall, it's getting late, and Mario Savio gets on the car to discuss next steps.
This car is here, been here for a long time. I'm gonna request that they bring Jack a chamber pot. You know these things, right?
So keep in mind that Jack Weinberg has been sitting in this police car this entire time. He then discusses what to do going into the night.
This car, I hope, if you stay sitting here, going to stay here all night, and as long as tomorrow morning is necessary, all night, this car's going to be, is that right?
So at about 11 p.m., the plaza is invaded by about 100 frat boys who arrive and they try to rush the car. The students block them. In response, throughout the night, the frat boys heckle speakers, they throw lighted cigarettes, eggs, and tomatoes. They also attempt to drown out speakers. So people from the top of the car try to tell students around to not get provoked, not to let things escalate, and that it was important to keep the demonstration going, but to keep it disciplined. So it's worth keeping in mind that though the students overwhelmingly supported the FSM, there were haters, and unsurprisingly, the Greeks were strong among those. Later, some hate mail would be found on the garbage can at Mario Savio's apartment, which kind of doubled as the headquarters of the FSM. Here's what the hate mail said. Please don't take any garbage. The fire department needs an excuse to close down this communist-sponsored, pinko-oriented, slack-jawed, rabble-rousing, unpatriotic, dribble-spouting, root-gnawing, malodorous mafia of overprivileged, underbrained, bleeding-hearted megalomaniacs. So anyway, 200 students spend the night, and then the demo continues into the next day. Throughout the day, there's more speakers. At about 5 p.m. the next day, negotiations begin between the students, administrators, and faculty in a very serious way. And two-thirds of the student negotiators had been arrested in civil rights demonstrations. So again, you see the importance of that in helping them in the struggle. Meanwhile, outside, 500 students, most of whom for which this is their first demonstration ever, they don't belong to any political org, but 500 students are preparing to be arrested. And on the top of the car, civil rights veterans, lawyers, and so on are giving advice about this. At about 7:30, Mario Savio announces that a pact was formed. The agreements are to stop the demo, to set up a committee which will determine regulations on free speech that will be constituted of administrators, faculty, and students. There will be no charges against Jack Weinberg. The discipline of those 8 suspended students would be submitted to a faculty committee, not an administrative committee, and that Bancroft intersection would go to the city, so now tables would be able to set up there again. And he announces that Monday at noon on Sproul there would be an open discussion for people to say what they think, but then people agree to leave and the demo ends after 32 hours, and I assume that the police car was driven away finally. So just as a side note, beginning now and throughout the rest of the movement, there would be constant red baiting from the administration, from the press, and even the FBI began an investigation of the FSM activists that didn't turn up anything. But Clark Kerr would make statements like, quote, some elements have been impressed with the tactics of Fidel Castro and Mao Zedong. So over the following weekend, this demo ends on a Friday, and then over the following weekend, the representatives of some of these clubs met and formed the FSM, which was basically a set of committees and a large group of students. Graduate students also met and formed the Graduate Coordinating Committee, which would play a very important role, especially towards the end of the movement. The FSM, you know, was run in a way very similar to the police car sit-in. There was what Hal Draper called remarkable feats of what appeared to be organization. But, you know, so things would get done, but he also describes it as a mess. You know, students are first getting organized for the first time. A lot of things are haphazard. He describes the endless debates that the FSM steering committee would get into, go on all night, go on for days, things that some of us might also be familiar with. So anyway, you have this discipline committee and this speech committee. The administration, while it said that the discipline committee would be a committee of faculty, it turned out not to be. They decided to make it a committee picked entirely by the administration. The speech committee, while it was supposed to be have representatives from the students, faculty, and administration, the administration unilaterally appointed all but 2 of the student representatives, all of the faculty representatives, and of course the administration representatives. At the very first meeting of that committee, the FSM delegation read a statement in protest of this, you know, basically bad faith negotiation and walked out. On the October 15th, the FSM published a leaflet giving an ultimatum for, quote, almost anything substantive in terms of good faith negotiations by 5 p.m., or it would conclude that the October 2 pact was voided and they would continue direct action. Finally, the administration agrees to make some concessions. It gives faculty control over the discipline, but says it's only going to be advisory to the administration, and that it will allow students to appoint their own representatives to the speech committee. So just as an aside, one thing that was useful, at least as from a historical perspective, about the speech committee is that you get an understanding of what the different groups' positions on free speech were. So the student's position was basically that the university should not be regulating political speech on campus at all. That if something was constitutionally protected off campus, it should be constitutionally protected on campus. The administration made some concessions in its position. It said that, yes, stuff is protected on campus, but if you are planning illegal off-campus action, then you can be punished for that. So this basically amounts to prior restraint. It means the administration can basically decide whether or not what you're doing is about to be illegal. And as many people would admit, as later faculty, even anti-FSM faculty would later admit, this was basically an attempt to stop the civil rights movement because the illegal off-campus actions were sit-ins, were pickets that were illegal. An FSM leaflet would say that these rules work a grave hardship on the civil rights movement in Northern California. So after these stalled negotiations on November 2nd, the FSM puts out a notice in its newsletter. And I'm going to quote this in full because it's really worth using this to counter the idea that the FSM was about, you know, sitting down at the table and having negotiations and conversations like liberals would want us to believe. We do not know how long the already established committees will take, and we do not even know that the administration will listen to their decisions. But let it be known that we can be stopped only by so many detours before the road begins to lead to nowhere, and then there will be only one road, that of direct action. We continue to meet in growing frustration and with deepening doubts as to the value of the committee proceedings. We repeat, when the morass of mediation becomes too thick to see through, action must let in the light. On November 7th, there's a pretty heated debate in the FSM, one of these endless debates, over whether or not direct action should be resumed. And there were some organizations that were split. You know, the International Socialists were on one side, the Democrats were on the other side. Organizations like SNCC were split down the middle. And a few days later, some of the moderate students would meet in secret with Clark Kerr and try to sell out the FSM. So they make an agreement, but then Clark Kerr sold them out, and so then they were in this position where they basically betrayed the movement and had nothing to show for it. So then a couple days later, for the first time since the police car sit-in and rally, the FSM sets up tables on Sproul at noon. The deans come up and they take names. People are very willingly give their names. The deans give up after they take down 75 names, but then 800 students sign statements saying they also violated the rules and send those to the administration. On November 10th, the GCC, the Graduate Coordinating Committee, sends 200 TAs to join the tablers. And the day after that, 300 TAs meet to discuss forming a union. So the regents have a meeting on November 20th. 5,000 students rally on Sproul Hall and march over to the meeting, hoping to pressure the regents to accede to their demands. They're disappointed. The regents agree to reduce the suspensions to probation. However, they're going to now institute discipline for the police car sit-in. All of that discipline is going to now go before the administration's committee, so they're taking the power away from the faculty. They also agree to hire more campus cops, and they adopt the administration's position of saying that students cannot plan off-campus illegal actions. So the FSM is very demoralized at this point, and for the next week, they're still doing actions, they're still setting up tables. At one point, they try to do a sit-in that's what's referred to as an abortive sit-in because it was very disorganized. Very few people participated. I mean, very few people, 300 participated, which for them was a small amount. But it wasn't organized, and this is a kind of a period of disarray. However, on November 28th, this is the Saturday after or during the Thanksgiving break, the administration sends letters to Mario Savio and three other students saying that they are potentially going to be expelled for the police car sit-in. So this is kind of shocking, right? Because at the police car sit-in, they negotiated with these students, right? And they agreed that they were going to do good faith negotiations on regulations on campus, but apparently the entire time, which they didn't say, they were also ready to expel these very same students for the actions that they were taking. And even anti-faculty who were opposed to the free speech movement were shocked by this action. And it enrages students and kind of reinvigorates the movement. So a few days later, a packed meeting of the graduate students decides to call a strike for December 4th. On December 2nd, a free speech movement leaflet is sent out, which has an ultimatum to drop the charges, to announce there being no new punishments, and to improve free speech regulations. They say, quote, if no satisfactory reply is given by noon, we will begin massive direct action to force the administration to heed us. And so they do. On December 3rd, the next day, they call a rally at which 6,000 students attend, and Mario Savio gives what becomes a very famous speech at noon.
We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. if President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the region in his telephone conversation, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, and I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw material, but we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, we're human beings. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
So that Draperian rhetoric is pretty awesome. So over 1,000 students then marched into Sproul, and they occupied the building overnight. The cops locked the door at 7 p.m. So the sit-in begins, and the structure of it is kind of amazing, so I'll just briefly describe it. The fourth floor is set aside as a study hall. The second floor is set aside for people to watch films. Throughout the building, graduate students teach various classes. There's a food distribution center. And the students clear out aisles so that workers can get by, and they don't open any offices, they don't disturb the building at all, very much, aside from shutting it down. A student describes it as such. It was, quote, an open marketplace of ideas where learning becomes an exciting process. It was the first time in my entire experience at the university that I gathered with a large number of my fellow students and learned purely for the sake of learning. So, like, what a crazy idea. So meanwhile, the power structure is obviously reacting, and there's negotiations ongoing about how to react to this. Clark Kerr is trying to convince Governor Brown to not send in the cops. These are the governor's police, not the local ones. Because, you know, as a smart liberal, he knows that it would cause a reaction and that it would actually set them back. The Alameda County DA, who was infamous for prosecuting black sailors during World War II, who refused to load munitions after explosions had killed others, that DA convinces Brown to send in the cops. And Brown would later recount that he actually wanted to arrest the students at the police car sit-in. So this, again, is the liberal governor of California. So at 3:15 a.m., Chancellor Strong goes level floor to floor in Sproul Hall and announces to the students that they need to leave.
May I have your attention, please? I am Dr. Edward Strong, Chancellor, the Berkeley campus. I have an announcement. This assembly has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired.
So anyway, 800 students remain in Sproul Hall, and the police begin their arrests, and they're very brutal. Because they were taught by the civil rights leaders of this sit-in, the students go limp when they're arrested. And so the police basically drag them down the stairs and make a particular effort to bump them down as they go. Here's how one demonstrator recounted her interaction with police. And she's discussing the act of going limp.
And I said to myself, if he can do that, that's what I'm going to try to do. So when they got to me, they said, do you want to walk out like a lady, or are you going to get dragged out? And I said, I want to get dragged out like a lady.
So as the cops are doing this, they paper over the windows of the stairwell so that outside observers can't see. They don't let any observers in. They also hide their badges so that students wouldn't be able to identify them. So the arrests begin at 3:15 a.m. It's not until 3:30 p.m. that the 800 arrests finally finish. This is the largest mass arrest in California history. Even after this, and probably because of this whole ordeal, students favor the FSM by a majority. A poll was done. So meanwhile, there's a faculty that are collecting a bail fund that amounts to about $85,000. Hundreds of cars go to the Santa Rita jail, including 50 professors, to get students out. And so this mass bringing of the cops onto campus is what finally starts to push some faculty into the realm of outrage. So during this sit-in, a few students, including Joel Geyer and Steve Weissman, one of the leaders of the graduate student movement, left the sit-in to go organize a strike. And Steve actually apparently climbs down a rope from a window down onto the floor. So there's basically two sides of this being planned. There's a student strike being planned of undergraduates not going to class, and there's also a TA strike being planned. As I said, graduate students have been discussing unionizing, have been discussing their relation to the FSM throughout the semester. And Hal Draper, because of his role in the student movements of the 1930s, had also been raising it and pushing for that to be one of the final actions. So anyway, it's December 3rd, the next day. The arrests are still ongoing. Joel Geyer is standing at Bancroft at 7 a.m. with signs and markers. As he told me, he was not super optimistic about the success of the strike, but within 15 minutes, 200 people were on the picket line because they come onto campus and they see their fellow students being arrested and brutalized by cops. The graduate coordinating committee met and moved the strike up to happen immediately, and this made it very clear to students that, you know, if your TAs go on strike, the people who teach the classes, you now have no reason to come to school. By 9 a.m., 10 to 15 delivery trucks had been turned away because the Teamsters agreed not to cross picket lines. At a construction site in the afternoon, the carpenters, whose union had picketed the regions just recently, agreed to not return to work after lunch. The Building Services Union and the San Francisco Labor Council issued a statement of support, and students at UC Davis picketed Governor Brown in Sacramento. So while all this is going on, you know, the arrests are happening, the strike is happening, there's a rally of 5,000 students at Sproul Hall. At one point, the police try to stop the rally to go and grab the microphone, and a ball of students basically get up and physically stop the cops from moving forward. Meanwhile, an emergency faculty meeting of 900 adopts a resolution that's essentially the FSM positions on free speech, and 361 of them sign a telegram condemning Governor Brown for sending the cops onto campus. The strike is overwhelmingly successful. Two departments canceled classes entirely. Most TAs, the FSM guests, at about 900 out of the 1,200 TAs went on strike. And the task force found that well over half of the classes were canceled. Some professors still met on campus and discussed the strike. Others met off campus, and some dismissed their class totally. One professor of U.S. history releases his class because it would be, quote, inappropriate to study the rebels of the past while we seek to silence the rebels of the present. Here's how Hal Draper describes the Berkeley strike. Quote, the strike of December 3rd to 7th, 1964, lasting through three full school days, was undoubtedly the longest and most massive student strike in this country, and it demanded nothing less than a backdown by the administration of the largest campus of the largest state university in the country. It was instrumental in winning a great deal for students, and there were no reprisals. It was probably the mightiest and most successful single effort of any kind ever made by an American student body in conflict with authority. So over the weekend, the administrators and the faculty began to get organized to figure out how they're going to respond to this. An ad hoc committee of department chairmen meet with Clark Kerr, the regents, and the deans at the Hilton at the San Francisco airport, and they decide to try to preempt the movement by agreeing to give all of the students amnesty. So they basically said, now that everyone's been arrested and is being prosecuted in court, we'll agree to drop all university charges. On December 7th, there's a big convocation at the Greek Theater on campus, which is like this big auditorium. It's very beautiful, it's very majestic. Clark Kerr gets up and gives a speech to 17,000 students. It's a flowery speech about, oh, the power of persuasion, we need to be constructive, and he endorses this proposal of amnesty. After him, Mario Savio goes up to speak. Right before he gets to say a word, he's grabbed by the throat by cops. He goes limp and they take him off stage, and thousands of students rush the stage. This is symbolically terrible, right? Clark Kerr gives this speech about the power of persuasion. The symbol of free speech on campus gets up to speak and he's violently removed. He realizes his mistake. He says that he didn't ask the cops to do this, but you know, whatever. He lets Mario return, who says, come to Sproul. 10,000 students come. And the free speech movement says, look forward to the next academic senate meeting because faculty are going to be putting forward a resolution with the FSM's positions. So anyway, the next day there is the faculty senate meeting that's twice the normal size. Thousands of students are outside waiting. And the faculty basically passed a resolution which says that students should only, any discipline of students should be brought before the faculty. And that off-campus illegal action should not be restrained by the university. So it's very much the FSM's positions on free speech. and it's the motion's passed 824-115. So that shows the, like, over the course of the semester, even while the faculty had largely started as a very quiet and unhelpful group, by the end of the semester they had been pushed. And many of them, you know, would later recount that they didn't necessarily agree with what the free speech movement was asking for, but they had to. They didn't have a choice anymore. I mean, the campus was being shut down and they had to give in because of the strength of that action. So the FSM publishes a leaflet that's called Happiness is an Academic Senate Meeting. And just as a side note, on that same day, Mario Savio turns 22. So in my notes in Hal Draper's book, when it said that, I wrote, like, for fuck's sake, you gotta be kidding me. It's like half inspiring and half, like, makes me feel inadequate. So anyway, a lot happens in the aftermath of the free speech movement. The regents meet and they don't agree to adopt all of the FSM's positions. So, like, they don't agree that faculty will get discipline powers. But effectively, the free speech is allowed on campus. So the old chancellor is let go, the new one eases policies. So outside speakers are now allowed, the Sproul Hall steps are opened up for tabling. There is a removal of the ban on fundraising and recruiting. So the free speech movement effectively wins many of its demands. One of the most important things that comes out of the free speech movement is a new trade union of teaching assistants and graduate student workers. So they form a local of the AFT and they have 450 members within a few months. There's a lot of other stuff to say. I mean, I'm coming up on way over time now. So I won't get into, you know, there's a trial where the lawyers make a lot of mistakes. They agree to waive the jury so they don't make it a political trial. So they learn lessons that they then later apply in the anti-war movement. A lot of radical groups like the International Socialist grow because of this. So the International Socialist Club hosts a conference in January on the free speech movement that 600 students attend. In the spring, students at Ohio State form a free speech front and do a sit-in at the administration building to protest the ban, that campus's ban on Marxist speakers. And there are similar revolts for free speech at UCLA, UC Riverside, UT Austin, and other major campuses. In Berlin, Germany, the student revolt there actually translates some of the FSM's handouts and passes those out. And the issues of civil rights and free speech continue. So in the fall of 1968, students invite Eldridge Cleaver to teach a course on racism. And this is part of a new kind of post-FSM educational initiative. The regents allow Cleaver one lecture in a very quickly assembled course. And in response, Cleaver leads a rally of 5,000 students on Sproul in chants of fuck Ronnie Reagan. So anyway, I mean, there's a lot to say. You know, the legacy of the FSM, the lessons that are learned are brought up in the anti-war movement. And that's one of the most important things to understand when thinking about these incorrect interpretations that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, is that one of the most important legacies of free speech is not just the fact that it got free speech for students, but that it injected politics in a way that students would then draw on in later movements. And actually, at Joel's talk yesterday on socialists and movements, this is one of his big points, that the movements of the early 60s set the stage for the movements of the late 60s that we often think about. So anyway, just a few minutes to wrap up on these interpretations. Why is the right wrong in its interpretation of free speech? First of all, the free speech movement grew out of militant civil rights struggles that the Republicans and the conservatives were and are still opposed to. The Republicans and the FSM coalition opposed all illegal actions of the FSM, and as you've noticed, that's basically all of the actions of the FSM. Early on in the police car sit-in, conservative orgs announced in the Daily Cal that they were against the free speech ban, but they don't want disruption. Early on the second day, someone got up on the car and said that they were against the demonstration. Conservatives refused to join the FSM leadership and then really were not involved at all. And throughout this entire ordeal and later, the FSM and the Berkeley students were constantly attacked by the Republicans' hero, Ronald Reagan. The Free Speech Movement vets wrote that article saying that students should not disrupt Milo Yiannopoulos. What they get wrong on this, even though they are correct that the university should not cancel that speech, but what they get wrong is that the FSM broke the rules of civility constantly. So it might well be the case that many of those students who participated would be against disrupting speeches, right? You know, this was a time of moderate politics. These were not a bunch of revolutionaries. But what they get wrong is the idea that the way we should react is to go and have a robust debate. That was not the attitude of the FSM, and that was not even the attitude of the rank and file. Thousands of students broke the law, they disrupted buildings, they disrupted operations. And so that's the problem with this kind of interpretation. And then lastly, what do the ultra-lefts get wrong when they say the FSM is a politically tepid movement? Again, the FSM set the stage and began the campus radicalization for the anti-war movement. This radicalized many activists, and you know, even as Clark Kerr recalls, he says the revolt of 1964 was basically about dissatisfactions with off-campus conditions involving civil rights and lack of on-campus opportunities to oppose them. So the idea that the FSM was a shift away from civil rights activity is completely ridiculous. I mean, the point of the free speech fight was because their actions for civil rights were being restricted. And then again, they say that, you know, conservatives were in this coalition, that's a problem, and really, it's important, like, the conservatives didn't play any role, right? I mean, they were formally part of the organization, they were not part of the leadership, they were not part of the rank and file. And so, I mean, when it comes to the free speech movement, there's a lot of stuff to learn just from, you know, I think for me personally, listening to the audio of the movement, listening to the speakers, I learn a lot as a student activist. But in a broad sense, the FSM started the student movement in Berkeley and nationally. It mobilized thousands of students. It started the grad student union at Berkeley, and it set the stage for the anti-war movement. And that's the legacy of the FSM that we need to remember and carry on today.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.